Welcome to episode 9 of Old Stories, New Information. I'm your host, Brent Colley, and once again, I am joined by Mike Allen, a friend of mine, historian, radio journalist, storyteller, and longtime Connecticut resident who hosts this amazing podcast, Amazing Tales from Off and On, Connecticut's Beaten Path. And I suggest you all look that one up because we're talking about one of those tales right now today. So just to recap what we discussed in episode number 8, we're talking about the old Leatherman. And there were two time periods to this story. And we also just touched base on the researchers of the Leatherman, gave information on the leather suit, its purposes, and, you know, its value. And then a little bit on his loop, slash route, from Hudson River to the Connecticut River and then back down around Long Island Sound, mostly in Connecticut, but there were parts of Westchester and Putnam counties in New York that he hit. And we also touched based on his caves. But in this discussion, we'll start off with his identity because, as we noted in episode 8, no one knows who he was. So Mike, obviously we've discussed this offline a lot, but I think for the most part, the hoaxes were created by the newspapers.
As right? They often were in those days. People like to comment about how you can't trust what you read in the newspaper today. And yeah, I'd be the first one as a former journalist to tell you, you should always be careful what you hear or read about news, read it from several sources. However, I got to tell you, in the old days, it was far worse than it is today. We didn't have anything close to fact checkers or anything like that. If you wrote a letter to the editor, it got published just as was. People used to write articles anonymously. It really was a wild, wild west in terms of the newspaper world. And so what happened was it was actually... this story involves the Waterbury paper, a Woodbury guy who ended up dying in Danbury, and he is singly responsible for probably the biggest hoax perpetrated on society in terms of the Leatherman that we know of. And the guy's name was William Gordon. Now, William Gordon came from a family in Woodbury that... had the Gordon Tannery, and the tanneries were places that the Leatherman used to like to come by and visit because they had the oils that he would use on his leather outfit to keep it well-oiled and smooth and not creaky and cracking. And so he would, come by Gordon's Tannery along with, there were a number of tanneries in Connecticut at the time because leather was everywhere. And William Gordon was what we used to call in the journalism field, if you didn't have a full-time job with the newspaper and you would instead write articles for several different newspapers, they would call you a stringer, and you would string along to different newspapers. And you might take the same story and write it to 5 or 6 different newspapers. Well, anyways, William Gordon was a stringer whose number one paper at the time was the Danbury News. That's where he used to get most of his articles published. Well, he had a younger brother who aspired to be a journalist and realized that maybe a quick way to get into fame and fortune in the newspaper business would be to write this huge expose on the Leatherman. So this is William Gordon's little brother. And so he writes an article for the local Woodbury paper that claims to know all the background of the Leatherman, because the Leatherman, after all, had been by Gordon's tannery, and he claimed that the Leatherman had opened up to them and had shared with them that he was actually from Poughkeepsie, New York, that he was a businessman, that his fiance had died, his business had burned to the ground, and he was now hopelessly just walking around the woods, trying to forget about his horrible situation. Well, it turns out, of course, that was all false, and because the Woodbury paper at that time did not have a wide circulation, it didn't get a lot of fanfare. Well, older brother William looked at this and realized, my younger brother may be onto something, although he didn't really manage to do much with this idea. So William Gordon decides he's going to write his own article, and he's got, of course, great contacts in the business, you know, in the newspaper field because he's writing for these papers already. And he goes to the Waterbury paper, and he writes an article under a pen name of W.A. Saleson. Now, Saleson was made up, but W.A. was William A. Gordon. So he took his first two initials from his own name, and then instead of Gordon, he used Saleson as his last name. And he publishes this unbelievable article that says, we know who the Leather Man is. And he used the same premise, you know, he's come by Gordon's tannery and blah, blah, blah. Well, it turns out, he says, the Leather Man's name is Jules Borglay. So now you've put a name on this guy, Jules Borglay, a nice French name because everybody knew he spoke French.
And just let me interject here. So, and just so everyone knows, the listeners, at this moment in time, the Leather Man is a celebrity. Everyone knows who he is.
Yes, and so this would be considered a coup d'etat to be able to unmask who this unknown Leather Man is. It would be like the Lone Ranger, taking off the mask of the Lone Ranger and saying, we now know, you know, who he is. And so he says he's Jules Borglay. He says he came from France and that he used to be a very, you know, prim and proper guy who wanted to marry this woman who was very well off in France. And in fact, her father was an accomplished leather trader in the country of France. And the father said, before you're going to marry my daughter, you've got to prove that you are competent in the leather trading business. And as the story went, he was proving his competence. He was moving up the ladder, doing very well, making great trades, until one day he made this calamitous trade. And unbeknownst to him, he basically took all of the money of the family and placed it into this major trade. And right after that, leather industry bottomed out, and the price of leather collapsed. The family was left penniless. He was, of course, kicked out of the family and told never to return. According to the article, he had a nervous breakdown, was institutionalized for 2 years, left France in shame, came over to the United States, and has been walking in penance since then, trying to walk off his guilt. Well, this story gets published in the Waterbury paper, and because there's so much interest in the Leather Man, everybody reads it, other papers pick it up, it gets reprinted different places, and the hoax is on its way to being, you know, cemented in people's minds. Now, this is to the point that after the Leather Man died, a local historical society in Westchester County, which is where he passed away, actually had a headstone made up for him because he was buried in the paupers section of Sparta Cemetery in New York. And they said, well, he's got to have a proper headstone, and they have the headstone Jules Borglay. Well, it wasn't until a gentleman named Dan DeLuca, who was one of the three key people who really contributed information on the Leather Man, did the due diligence that found the Waterbury paper article that was published almost to the day, 5 years after the first one was published, that was a retraction. And it was the editor of the paper himself who said that that William Gordon came to him personally and said, yeah, I'm sorry, it was a hoax, I should have never done it. So he publishes this retraction on the front page of the paper, and DeLuca tracked this one down, and so he was able to say, this is not Jules Borglay. And it turns out that there is a story about a Jules Borglay. There was a play that was fairly popular at the time in France, closely resembled this story, that William Gordon had heard about. So he just basically plagiarized a lot of the details and turned it into a hoax about the Leather Man. Well, of course, just like anything else in journalism, if you don't happen to hear the retraction, but for 5 years you've been building up in your mind the original untrue story, you believe the untrue story, and it's going to take, you know, a team of wild horses to get you to change your mind. And so everybody was like, no, it's Jules Borglay. We know this because after all that article. Well, it wasn't Jules Borglay at all. And again, one of the biggest hoaxes ever placed on society in terms of the Leatherman. And, of course, the interesting part about this, to your point, Brent, is that to this day, we still don't know who this guy, the Leatherman, is.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. And that, you know, that, just so everyone knows, that went right to his gravestone. You know, they put that name on his gravestone. And only recently did they correct that. I believe they finally corrected it in 2011 or so.
Exactly, about 10 years ago.
So I mean that's how long the legs of that story had, and it's amazing. But then again, like, you got to think about it from the perspective of, you know, we all know. I mean, perception's reality, and that checked all the boxes. It made complete sense, and it was, you know, brilliantly written, because obviously everyone picked it up, and I'm sure that individual, William Gordon, made out very well on that story. But, yeah, we really never have found out who he truly was. I mean, through the autopsy, right, we found out he was, what, 5'7", 160?
Well, you know, sometimes when you go to a funeral and you hear somebody giving the eulogy, you learn something about a person in death that you never knew about them when they were alive. And I think the same can be said here about the Leatherman, because now he dies in 1889 in a cave, of course, by himself, on a piece of land in Mount Pleasant, New York, a farm owned by a guy named George Dell. And his body was found not by George Dell, but by some neighbors, this guy who was engaged to be married, and he and his fiance were there one day, and he says, you know, the Leatherman routinely comes to this cave on George Dell's property. You want to go up? I'll show you the cave. And she goes, oh, that sounds like fun. So they go up there. Well, when they get to the cave, and I think everybody's this way, you know, when you look at a cave at first, you think, oh, isn't that fun? Let's go in. And then when you start thinking about, geez, I don't know what's in there, you know, people sometimes have second thoughts about going in. And the fiancé said, yeah, I'm not going in. He goes, okay, I'll go check it out. So he walks in the cave, and he sees a boot. And attached to the boot is a leg. And, of course, now he has found the Leatherman's body. So now the Leatherman is removed for an autopsy, and the Sparta Cemetery in Osney, New York, was really the closest place to bury him. And he's taken for this autopsy, where he's found, as you said, to be about 5'7", 160, blue-gray eyes. And importantly for the story, they find out that he's in his 50s and probably was born in about the 1830s. And this fits in very nicely to some of the suggestions of where this guy was from and maybe, you know, where he went and over his lifetime. But something that happened there at the autopsy, which was really, to me, very interesting, and we'll come back to this a little bit later, but a wax museum from New York City came up and said, hey, can I buy that suit off you? And the undertaker did, and we'll come back to this whole thing a little bit later, but that was very interesting. And there were a number of other items that were either with the Leatherman at the autopsy or were found in the cave subsequently. Some of them are with the Connecticut Historical Society, and some of them are no longer, unfortunately, but we can get into that in just a little bit.
Yeah, that's interesting. So that was at New York City Museum, was probably like Meehan or Meechan and Wilson Globe Museum.
Yeah, I think
Valley,
it was
right?
Called the Eden Wax Museum, and it was on 23rd Street in Manhattan. And the guy, you know, made a wax figure of the Leatherman, put the Leatherman's outfit on him, and then charged admission for people to come look at him, just like all the other wax figures. And he made some money, but then apparently not enough, because he went bankrupt. And the bank and the creditors froze all of his assets, including the Leatherman suit. So for a couple of years, it was, nowhere to be seen, out of commission, in storage. And the guy comes out of bankruptcy. He opens a new wax museum instead of on 23rd Street in Manhattan. He's now on Coney Island in Brooklyn, right along the Atlantic Ocean. And he sets up shop there. Now, his intention, he said, was always to give this suit back to the Connecticut Humane Society. And I'll tell you that story in just a second. But unfortunately, what happened was the museum and a good portion of Coney Island that day was destroyed in a fire. And so the suit of the Leatherman was destroyed, never to be found again. The reason he wanted to give it to the Humane Society was that, in part one, we talked about the fact that Connecticut had passed a vagrancy law and that the Leatherman had been exempted from it because of, he was so beloved and whatnot. Well, in Middletown, Connecticut, 1 year before the Leatherman passed away, it was very clear, because everybody could see his mouth, that one of his lips was being severely impacted, and the speculation was by cancer. And so the Middletown authorities had him picked up as a vagrant one day as he was coming through town and brought to a local hospital so that a doctor could look at him and examine him. And the doctor indeed said, yes, yeah, he's got cancer. And the doctors went into a separate room to consult and talk about what they could do for him. And when they came back to talk to him, he was gone. He had got up and, left the hospital. And they debated for a little bit, should we go after him and chase him and bring him back and treat him? And they kind of looked at each other and said, this is how he wants to live his life. Who are we to second-guess how he's been his entire life? If he wanted to be treated, he'd still be sitting here waiting for us to come back. But the fact that he left, let's not make his life any more difficult than it already is. So the Connecticut Humane Society never got their suit, but the Connecticut Historical Society does have his pouch, his knapsack, I should say, his money pouch, and one of the two mittens that he was wearing. I think they also have a hatchet that they found at one of the caves. So those items still are, in the possession of Connecticut authorities, but the rest of it unfortunately got destroyed, or, there are also some people who stole some things from the caves, we know, unfortunately, and they probably have it in their private collections.
Yeah, but he only needed, the simple stuff. He didn't have any tools that really surprise anyone. It's just mostly his own little survival kit, and, not to mention the French prayer book and a crucifix, but mostly he survived with a minimal amount of items.
Yeah, when you look at it, if you've ever done any outdoor camping and hiking, as I did in my earlier days, you never go anywhere in the woods without a knife, and so he had a knife, and he also had an awl, which is used for punching holes in leather, which he would need to sort of keep his suit in good working order. He had a skillet with him. He did have the hatchet that was with him. But it was during the autopsy when they were able to empty out his knapsack and look for some things that they found this unusual stuff. And, again, the French prayer book and the crucifix that they found lined up very nicely with what they knew about him, which was that he also never ate meat on Fridays. So here you go, okay, this sounds very much like a Catholic person. He spoke French. We know he went to Canada a lot in his earlier days. So now you start to think maybe there's a French-Canadian connection, which we'll get into in a second. But he also had, which was, I thought, fascinating, were these papers that had this undecipherable code. Now, I don't know where the papers are, in 2023. I just don't know where they are. But people looked at the papers, apparently, and tried to break this code, and the best they could come up with was they think it was his notation of, I was at this house, they asked me a personal question, I'm not going back there again because I don't want to get into that discussion, and he would make a mark to know never to go back to that place. Because he, absolutely, once you asked that question, you never saw him again, and people wondered how he kept all that stuff straight on this, huge 364-mile circuitous route, and that could be one of the ways and one of the explanations.
No, it's a neat little puzzle piece. Unfortunately, we're missing a lot of the puzzle.
Yeah, well, you know, the other thing that, you know, Dan DeLuca took a stab at, you know, who could this guy have been? And he puts together those pieces of the puzzle that we do have and tried to apply some perhaps common sense or logic to it along the way. And I think it's fascinating the way he looked at it, because at these caves, we know that some of the survival skills that he used, particularly like carving out chestnut trees to store meat, which was, you know, highly effective, it was something that indigenous persons and Native Americans did more so than European settlers, for example. There were a lot of little tricks of the trade that he had that clearly indicated some knowledge from indigenous people. He also had, you know, traditional woodsman skills that would sort of indicate that somehow he grew up in that kind of influence. And so Dan DeLuca's final analysis was he thought the father was a French-Canadian woodsman, and he thought that the Leatherman's mother was an indigenous female, a member of a tribe. And, you know, before you think, oh, gee, that sounds unusual, that actually occurred all the time at about the time of the 1830s when he was supposed to have been born. This happened in that section of Canada routinely, that French Canadian and French Catholic woodsmen were marrying Native American women. And so it would not have been unusual at all that this occurred with the Leatherman. Now, again, if Dan DeLuca's speculation is that his parents died relatively young when he was in his 20s, and that that's when he set out and started wandering around the woods, you know, the woods and the hillsides, and that the reason why he would come back to Canada so frequently, he speculates, is that his mother's tribe welcomed him back, and that he could go and visit and, you know, and learn more and meet them and see them and spend some time with them. So this is, again, it's pure speculation. We have no idea, but it's a story I like to sort of align with. I think it all makes sense, and it certainly brings some comfort to me thinking, gee, I think I might actually understand who he is.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. I mean, obviously, he could definitely walk that far. I mean, in the 6 years that he was doing the loop, I think that's, people have speculated that's roughly 24,000 miles. And, you know, in terms of what you said about the Native American or indigenous tribes, you know, where his cave was, where I grew up, was in the same location where local Indian Chickamwerps hunted and fished. So when Dan DeLuca did visit, we, you know, went up through the pathway to the cave, and we passed a nice running stream, and he smiled, and I said, "What? Why?" He says, it checks the box. Like, all right. And then we got through, and like you said, there was, you know, a good amount of forest. And then the cave itself is very difficult to find. If you don't know where it is, you know, you can't, there's no way you're going to find it. But when we crawled up there and he saw it, he said, this is exactly what he would have loved. And for me, it was fun because, like I said, I found that old property map. But for years, not only myself and my brother and my cousin Timmy, but also the neighborhood kids, we would play in that place all the time. And what was neat about it, and it was my cousin Tim who really discovered it because he was an outdoors person, it had its own natural chimney. So the way that the rock had fallen upon the ledge on the back, if you built a campfire in the back, the smoke would naturally just go up through that hole. So we were able to use that cave all through the year. And, you know, there was no blowback and smoke. And as noted in the stories, once we got it to a certain heat, the granite would radiate heat, and we didn't have to really feed the fire that much. Obviously, we didn't want to let it go, but there was no real danger of burning down the forest because it was within this granite cave. And when I started to do my own research and see the photos of other caves around the state and, you know, the tri-state, they all look the same for the most part. I mean, yes, there's some just overhangs that maybe were added, you know, he added wood or, you know, lean-tos to. But for the most part, they all look that way. So that was fun. And to actually get to meet Dan DeLuca just before he passed away was a big thing. And, you know, we had a really good time hanging out in that cave because, you know, you can see exactly why he would have been there. It's just the perfect location.
Well, my envy side comes out because I didn't get to meet him, and I would have loved to have met him. You should consider yourself a lucky individual. You know, I just maybe one last story on this because, you know, we talked about the fact that the Leatherman's suit is gone. The part that also kind of raises eyebrows is when people realize, you know, as you pointed out, he had a headstone until 2011 when they decided to move his grave at Sparta Cemetery more inland and away from Route 9, busy Route 9 that goes right along the side of the cemetery, because there would sometimes be such large crowds that would come to pay homage that it was a safety concern. And when they went to rebury him, his body was gone, to make a very long story short. All they found were a couple scraps of leather and some coffin nails. They did not find the body, and they didn't find a skeleton. They didn't find anything, and they had an archaeological dig. They tried to look at it, and then they just couldn't find him, any evidence of him, because, of course, somebody would love to do a DNA test, and that's just not going to be possible. I'm going to hope to convince Connecticut authorities at some point to do a swab of the inside of one of those mittens and see if we can find something from there, but I'm sure a lot of people have tried them on since then, so it may be mixed results, but who knows? We'll see what we can find.
I think maybe one of the pipes. I mean, maybe that would provide something. But, yeah, no, I think, you know, the Leatherman, he's this unique, mysterious individual that we'll never solve, and that's the magic of the legend. And, you know, we keep crawling back to try to understand it, but we never seem to get any information that really helps us. And that's, I thought I'd tie in. So the show here begins with Tom Petty's Crawling Back to You. And I use that because that's what us historians do. We keep crawling back to subjects. And when I was going through the information in preparation of this, I noted that the lyrics of Crawling Back to You, there's a note that she thought she'd seen the last of him. She shook her head and let him in. And that plays true with the Leatherman because in January 25th of 1889, he visits my hometown of Reading. There was a doctor there, Dr. Benedict, and this particular woman could speak French. So she was able to talk to him, understand what he wanted. He wanted large bowls of coffee and, you know, milk. And he obviously at that moment in time couldn't partake in any solid foods because of the degree of the cancer, which was under his lip and was now heading into his throat area. And like you said earlier, everything was fine. She was talking with him. He obviously wasn't well. The cancer was eating away at his life. But as soon as she got into a personal question, he shut down. And then literally 55 days later, they find his body on March 20th. So it plays in so well to this, one of the greatest mysteries, I think, maybe not even Connecticut, the whole world has known.
Yeah, amen.
So, again, as we noted in Episode 8, we have an email account. So, you know, email us at stories@robinhoodradio.com and tell us what stands out, not with this topic, but of course with this topic, but all the topics, and we'll circle back. Mike Allen and I talk all the time, and we like to talk, as you know. So we are happy to find out what you're interested in, and find Mike at his podcast. He has over 100 episodes now on topics that I didn't even realize existed. So it's a lot of fun to listen to his episodes every Thursday. So, Mike, thank you for being with me today.
Enjoyed it immensely, Brent, as always. Keep up the good work.
We shall. So in the next episode, I'll be speaking with someone, but at this moment, we'll keep that individual a secret. Seems fitting after these past two episodes. And the fact that it'll be the 10th episode of Old Stories, New Information. So until next time, be well and always do right, because this will gratify some people and astonish the rest. Enjoy your week.
Old Stories, New Information, hosted by Brett Colley, is produced at the facilities of WHDD, RobinHoodRadio.com, Sharon, Connecticut.